Welcome to the weekend edition of the Daily Stoic. Each weekday, we bring you a meditation inspired by the ancient Stoics, something to help you live up to those four Stoic virtues of courage, justice, temperance, and wisdom. And then here on the weekend, we take a deeper dive into those same topics. We interview Stoic philosophers. We explore at length how these Stoic ideas can be applied to our actual lives and the challenging issues of our time. Here on the weekend, when you have a little bit more space, when things have slowed down, be sure to take some time to think, to go for a walk, to sit with your journal, and most importantly, to prepare for what the week ahead may bring. I'm just about to go into the studio to record my latest audiobook. My wife and I have been listening to audiobooks. We've been listening to audiobooks in the car as a family just to keep our kids off screens because Audible is amazing. And Audible is also the destination for thrilling audio entertainment with highly anticipated new releases and next-to-listen recommendations to satisfy every type of thriller listener. If you want breathtaking, sinister, and shocking tales that will enthrall you, even brand new and exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors, well, then you want to check out Audible. My wife and I were just raving about this true crime audiobook that we read called Furious Hours. And then I've been raving about this book, Night of the Grizzlies, which I loved. Audio piques the imagination and it brings thrillers to life. And as an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from the entire catalog. Visit audible.com/dailystoic or text dailystoic to 500-500. That's audible.com/dailystoic or text dailystoic to 500-500. The Daily Stoic is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. One of the cool things about podcasts is that you can multitask while you're listening, but depending on what you're doing right now, like for instance, if you're not in some kind of moving vehicle, there's something else you could be doing. You could be getting an auto quote from Progressive Insurance. It's easy and you could save money by doing it right from your phone. Drivers who save by switching to Progressive save nearly $700 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts, discounts for having multiple vehicles on your policy, being a homeowner, and more. So just like your favorite podcast, Progressive will be with you 24/7, 365 days a year, so you're protected no matter what. Multitask right now. Quote your car insurance at progressive.com to join over 29 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $698 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations. Hey, it's Ryan Holiday. Welcome to another episode of the Daily Stoic Podcast. I hope you haven't quit on your New Year's resolutions already. Hopefully you're in the challenge with us. It's been going nicely. I am trying to take a little time off here at the beginning of the year, trying to read, trying to reset, trying to cultivate some stillness and calm before the craziness of life begins once again. I hope you're doing the same. But before I headed off to do that, I had a conversation with my good friend, three-time podcast guest, someone I've known 10 years now, something like that, someone who's given me a lot of wonderful advice and guidance, someone I would consider both a peer and a friend, and someone whose work pushes me to be better. Talking about the one and only Mark Manson. His book, The Subtle Art of Not Giving a Fuck, was an enormous bestseller. Like, there are books that come out, there are books that do well, there are books that are hits, and then there are books that are freaks. And The Subtle Art of Not Giving a Fuck was a freak, an enormous success, millions upon millions of copies sold. So too was the sequel, Everything is Fucked, a book about hope. To say they were New York Times bestsellers would be to undersell what sensations they absolutely were. And Mark isn't some overnight success, though. He's been writing online since 2008. He started his blog, markmanson.net, in 2013. It was in 2015 that his blog article, The Subtle Art of Not Giving a Fuck, came out, which would form the basis of his book. And more excitingly, the sort of subtle art phenomenon has been turned into a movie, a documentary about these same ideas. It debuted in select theaters on January 4th. It's going to be available for rent and streaming and digital download on a million different platforms. I'll link to that in today's show notes on January 9th. You can follow Mark at Mark Manson on Instagram. You can follow him on Twitter. I am Mark Manson. And then markmanson.net. He has an amazing email newsletter that I've gotten for many years. I love the sort of carousels that he posts on Instagram. They're always thoughtful. And a fellow metalhead, fellow writer, a good dude, originally from Austin, Texas. And I hope you enjoy this episode from Mark Manson about philosophy, about the catastrophe of success, about philosophy, about discipline, and many, many other topics. Enjoy. You know, I was thinking, have you read Tennessee Williams' essay, The Catastrophe of Success?
I have not.
I think you would like it. It's really interesting. His point was that like life without struggle is meaningless, and that mm-hmm. one of the problems of success is that it removes a lot of the day-to-day struggle, right? He's like, suddenly you're not cleaning up after yourself. Suddenly you're not, you know, necessarily as motivated because you don't need this or that. And so that basically getting to go to another sort of playwright's idea that the two worst things that can happen to a person are not getting what they want and getting everything that they want.
That's a that was Oscar Wilde's quote,
yes.
Right?
Yeah.
It sounds like it's in my wheelhouse for sure. It's not only is it something I write about, but it's something I've lived to a certain extent over the last 5 years.
Yeah, it's weird too because like there's success and then there's also like catastrophic success, right?
Yeah.
Like there's like the, hey, you worked really hard and after 30 years, you got promoted to full professor at insert university. And then there's the youngest professor in the history of Harvard or something. Do you know what I mean? There's like yeah. regular success and extreme success. And you certainly had extreme success relative to what we do, right? Like there are
yes.
many Silicon Valley people who nobody has ever heard of who would be like, that's not catastrophic success. That's not even success at all, right? So it's
yeah.
all this stuff is relative, but it does strike me that there's getting what you wanted and then there's getting more than you could have ever possibly dreamed of.
Well, the best description of this phenomenon I heard it was actually relayed to me by Will Smith when we were working on the book together, because I asked him about this. Like, you know, after Subtle Art, it blew up so big and so fast. And as you know, we've talked about off like privately,
yeah.
You know, it fucked with me for a while. And I was asking him about it, and he told me, he said, you know, I didn't experience that, but he said it's such a common thing in show business. And he said that Quincy Jones used to call it altitude sickness.
Mm.
And he used to say that, you know, when he was a music producer, he would see that, you know, the same way when you climb a mountain, you need to like stop and acclimate at certain levels to
yeah.
like prevent yourself from passing out. If you just go straight to the peak, you get altitude sickness and you fall off and kill yourself. And I love that analogy. Like it makes a lot of sense to me. There's like an acclimation process of certain levels of success that you go through.
Yeah, no, that makes total sense. Well, one of the things Tennessee Williams is talking about in the essay, he's talking about like when he was sort of in the thick of it, he'd blown up, he's working on it. He was like, I lived on hotel room service. And he was like, how fundamentally abnormal that was. It's like great food every night, delivered right to your door. Like you don't clean it up. You don't worry about where it came from. You didn't worry about waiting in line. Like just like every part of it is stripping the just minor inconveniences and struggle of life. And that is fundamentally warping and unnatural and not good for you.
Yeah. And not only that, you're replacing it with these like grand existential struggles of like, do I deserve this?
Mm-hmm.
what if I fuck up and lose everything? What if I just got lucky? You know, so it's I found myself at a certain point like longing for those kind of dull quotidian struggles and concerns.
Interesting. Yeah, it's funny, like growing up, like just specifically of room service, like I was under the impression that like, if we ordered room service in a hotel, it would like bankrupt us as a family. Do you know what I mean? Like my parents, the idea that one could just, could do this and should do this, you know, was inconceivable to me. And then, you know, you get to a place where, hey, actually it makes more financial sense to just order room service than go downstairs and to avoid all the inconveniences that we're just talking about. And then it does, though, it skews your sense of what's like normal and not normal. And maybe that stuff is actually important in terms of being a grounded person.
Yeah. I know, so I'm friends with Derek Sivers, and he had a catastrophic success. He sold his company for $30 or $40 million or whatever. And he said that he developed a practice. I don't know if he still does it, but for a number of years, he would make a point to once a year fly coach somewhere, stay in like a dingy hostel,
yeah,
you know, eat trashy street food, you know, basically put himself on the same budget that he had when he was 20 years old. And just do that for like 4 days. They remind himself of like, okay, this is normal life.
Yeah.
You know, don't lose touch with it.
Well, there's a passage in one of Seneca's letters where he says like, we should do that every month. He said, you should like wear your worst clothes, eat the worst food, you know, sleep on the floor in your house. And he said, the point of that, it wasn't just like play acting or anything. He was like, the point was that he was saying that one of the costs of success is actually not security, but a kind of fear, because you're afraid of losing all the things that you're really comfortable with, right?
Yep.
And he's like, you want to get comfortable with the way that, by the way, most people alive currently live. You know what I mean? Like, it's very survivable what you're afraid of, but you're afraid of it because it's unfamiliar to you, because you've distanced yourself from it. And he said the whole point of this sort of practicing poverty and adversity was to be able to say to yourself at the end of that exercise, is this what I was so afraid of? You still go back to your regular or your good life, but you're not waking up in the middle of the night going, what if I get robbed? What if I get canceled? What if I fall off? Because you go, the worst case scenario is I just go back to how things used to be.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, I just pulled up the essay, and I'd be curious what you think of this. Tennessee Williams says, security is a kind of death, I think, and it can come to you in a storm of royalty checks beside a kidney-shaped pool in Beverly Hills or anywhere at all that is removed from the conditions that made you an artist, if that's what you are intended to be. Ask anyone who has experienced the kind of success I am talking about, what good is it?
Well, that's the perennial question, right? Is too much comfort, does a certain amount of discomfort a prerequisite for good art?
Yeah.
And I think that's definitely open for debate, but it's there might be something to it.
Well, have you found it hard to be creative or disciplined or to do the uncomfortable thing when you are not doing it for any need? Or is it actually better because you're doing it only when and because you want to do it?
I think now, so I kind of look at, you know, my post-catastrophic success life in two phases. I think the original phase was actually motivated, in hindsight, it was motivated a lot by fear. And it was that fear was, or maybe not fear, but like insecurity. And I think a lot of that insecurity was like, this might be my 15 minutes, say yes to everything, do everything.
Sure.
You know, because it might not come around again. And, you know, I think that's a reasonable position to take. I don't necessarily regret it, but it did lead to a period of kind of overloading on projects that I wasn't, some of them I enjoyed a lot, but it wasn't, you know, if you put me in a vacuum and said, what do you want to do with the next 3 years? It wasn't necessarily what I would have chosen. It was the stuff that was coming to me rather than me sitting down and deciding what I was going to pursue. And then, you know, unsurprisingly, that period led to a pretty intense burnout about a year ago. and I took 6 months off. And I think in those 6 months off, I kind of reached that conclusion that you just said, where I'm like, wait a second, I'm fucking rich and successful. Like, I don't need to do anything I don't want to do. And since then, I feel like I'm in a really good spot psychologically.
I think taking 6 months off, it's the prospect of that seems very scary to me. Financially, it makes no sense that that would be scary, right? Like, I haven't thought about money the last 6 months, right? So I don't know. I don't know why that would be scary to me. There's probably relevance is probably something that scares people. And then maybe there's even a, like, if I stop doing it, will I lose the ability to keep doing it? Like, will the skills get rusty or the magic stop or something like that?
Yeah, there was definitely a lot of insecurities around it. And I'll be honest, like the first 2 months or so, it was really difficult. And it for a lot of those reasons, I was like, it felt kind of like I was burning my career to the ground.
Yeah.
Which in hindsight was a very irrational feeling. But, you know, a lot of the thoughts you just mentioned were absolutely in my mind quite a bit. But I think, especially, you know, in the career that we're in, like the thing that I come back to is if I think about what, you know, I don't know, if you're a fan of the band Tool, like Tool went 15 years between releasing albums.
Right.
And I listened to that album the day it came out. Like, I didn't stop being a Tool fan. I didn't stop being excited for their next album because they didn't put anything out for 15 years. And so you kind of forget that, like, when people like you, not only are they willing to wait, but they might even be more excited if you go away for a while and then come back. And honestly, I have to say, coming back after those 6 months, it doesn't feel like I really, like, it took a little bit of time for things to kind of ramp up again, maybe like a month, but it doesn't really feel like I lost anything.
Well, objectively, when a band takes a big break between albums, when they come back, there's, like in the case of Tool, 15 years of people discovered the band Tool. Yeah, maybe some people outgrew the band Tool, although probably not really that many. But a bunch of people who were 5 when they took a break are now 20. You know, but you don't think about it that way. You don't think about every year kids graduate from high school, every year kids graduate from college, every year X, Y, or Z happens, and those people become part of the pool of your potential fan base or, you know, customers or whatever the thing that you're thinking about. But instead, we think only of the sort of, but are the people who know about me right now going to forget about me? There's kind of a narcissism to it.
There definitely is. There's a little bit of like, I'm the center of, because all these people are the center of my universe. I must be the center of their universe. Yes. You know?
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's also funny. This would be a Stoic concept too, is like the way it is framed to you determines whether it feels, you know, good or bad. So like, if you had cancer and you had to take 6 months off to get chemotherapy, you'd be like, I'm so excited to get back to my career. I'm going to fight for it, blah, blah, blah. You know, you wouldn't be thinking, oh, I can't believe I ruined my career by taking 6 months off. But if you voluntarily take the same period off, you're like, I'm never going to recover from this. Everyone will forget me, et cetera. It's like, the way we frame the event, whether it's something in our control or not in our control, like when it's objectively outside of our control, we understand it just is what it is. But when we're choosing it, then we load it up with this sort of moral judgment about whether we should be doing it or not do it.
Yeah. And there's a lot of kind of baked in deep-seated assumptions around laziness and, you know, productivity and, you know, your value as a human. Like if you're just sitting around playing video games every day, like, you know, you're wasting your life. And that, you know, you wrestle with that as well. It's funny too. Like one thing that kind of surprised me about this year coming back because it's you know, it's things have dropped off a little bit the last few years. There's traffic is lower, engagement is lower. You know, it's my books have been out for 4, 5, 6 years now. So obviously there's less excitement, less engagement out there in the world. And I'm doing new things. And I realized that like, I like being, I don't want to say the underdog, but like, I like being, having to like claw my way back up again. I don't, if that makes sense. Like that, it feels, it's a much more comfortable position for me psychologically than being like, feeling like I'm on top of the mountain, desperately trying to stay up there. And like I enjoy the climb and the process, and I kind of enjoy, I almost relish the idea that maybe people don't expect me to stick around or something. I don't know.
Well, so philosophically, is it wasting your life to sit around and play video games? Like, what's your take on that? Like, you could literally never work another day in your life. You could only do, you know, sort of pleasure-seeking activities. Why wouldn't a person just do that? What's the argument for doing it or not doing it?
Well, I mean, I think you would have to attach a moral argument to some sort of like productivity or creativity, which I think there is a strong moral argument for that. I came to the conclusion that I am just not constitutionally a person. I'm not built to not be productive. Like it just, some amount of productivity really makes me happy.
Sure.
It's just a question of what that productivity is. But I definitely do know people and have seen people who certainly seem completely able to sit around and play video games for the rest of their life and not feel any like any pangs of guilt or existential dread or anything. And yeah, I don't know. I kind of go back and forth on that question. I don't know, honestly. What do you think?
I mean, if a person has a gift, like an ability to do a thing, putting money aside, you know, if their work is a positive good for the world or improves other people's life, like to what extent is that person obligated to do that thing?
Yeah.
I don't know. It's a tricky question.
I don't know either. I mean, you could come at it from both angles that it's increasing the social good is the moral imperative, or the autonomy and the fulfilling of the individual's desires, the moral imperative. And, you know, who knows? Like, you could probably argue for 1,000 years about it.
Yeah. It's like, you don't owe anyone anything. And yet you also owe people. It's like, both things are both simultaneously true, make perfect, like intuitive sense. And there's probably a strong moral argument that would feel convincing in both directions.
Yeah. Absolutely.
I think ideally you get to a place where not like you do the work because it's your duty. It's the role sort of chosen for you by random circumstances and luck and all these things. And you get to a place where you find the way to do it and think about it through which it is both challenging, but also enjoyable and pleasurable to you at the same time. So basically it comes down to this sort of idea of balance or moderation. That's probably the sweet spot. You don't have to make yourself, you know, a mule that works itself to death on behalf of other people. And yet also indolence and laziness and purposelessness is probably not actually in the long run the happiest or most fulfilling way to live.
Yeah, I don't know. I struggle to really think that people can do that for an extended period of time while being an emotionally healthy person. Like it seems like that the only way that is a sustainable lifestyle is if there's something that they're running from or avoiding or burying in themselves. You know, because I think about like my 6 months off, you know, I dicked around for the first month or so, but then I was like, you know what? You know, because the period of 2017 to 2021, I worked so insanely hard. I was traveling so much. My health, like I basically got fat and like was unhealthy and out of shape, and you know, I'm approaching 40. And so those are things I'm like, I need to get this shit together. So I actually spent most of those 6 months just working out, hiring a health coach, getting my diet straightened out, you know, cutting back on drinking, lost a bunch of weight. So in a way it was like, I was still being productive. It was just, I was being productive on something very like personal and individual that I had neglected for a long time.
I've talked a lot about my morning routine here. One of the things I do every morning after I get up is I take a bunch of vitamins that my doctor recommended after some blood tests. I take a vitamin C, a zinc, a omega-3, and I take a couple others who I'm forgetting, but I definitely know whose vitamins I take. And they actually happen to be today's sponsor, and I've been taking them long before Thorne sponsored today's episode. Thorne takes a personalized, innovative, and scientific approach to health and wellness with all their supplements, and they've teamed up with leading medical professionals to bring out highly effective nutritional supplements. Because I'm a runner, I'm always trying to take care of my joints. And with Thorne, I never have to question what's in each supplement. Give your body what it really needs with Thorne. Go to thorne.fit/dailystoic and use code dailystoic for 10% off your first order. That's thorne.fit/dailystoic and use code dailystoic for 10% off your order. thorne.fit/dailystoic. Use code dailystoic. And note, these statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business and evolving your passions. We push what technology can do so great ideas can happen now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
Well, there's that Abraham Lincoln thing. It doesn't actually sound like something he said, but maybe he did. But about like, if you're supposed to chop down a tree, you know, you spend most of the time sharpening the axe. There's an argument that actually, if you're going to do this over a long period of time, if you want to do it without burning out or hurting yourself, or if you actually want to be, you know, sort of metaphorically sharp, you had to spend some time stepping away, getting in shape, taking care of yourself, getting your priorities straight so that what you brought back to the work was the best version of yourself.
Yeah, that certainly feels true. I feel more energetic and motivated than I have in probably 7 or 8 years.
Interesting. Why do you think your health suffered? Do you think it was you just didn't have the energy to focus on it? Do you think it was like, why was that happening? Because it's not like you were working 20 hours a day in a coal mine. Like, I'm sure you could have figured it out.
It was a combination of things. I think the primary one is it's two things. One, I think a lot of people can relate to, and then one was maybe a little bit more specific and individual to me. But the one I think most people can relate to is that I had a set of habits that you can get away with when you're 25, you can get away with when you're 30, but by the time you're 35, you can't really get away with it anymore. And so I think that there would have, even if my career wasn't going through kind of this crazy phase, there would have had to be some sort of reevaluation there of some basic lifestyle habits that would have had to be done. It probably would have been much simpler and less drastic than it ended up being, but you know, it would have had to happen anyway. The second thing is just, I really overloaded myself over, you know, 2018, 2019, 2020. Just really overloaded myself with work. Like I said, it kind of came back to like just saying yes to everything. I wrote 3 books at the same time. I did a movie. I did an audio original. At the same time, I was doing a weekly newsletter. I was doing speaking tours. I mean, I think 2018, 2019, I was on the road like 5 months a year. And so when you're on the road constantly, you're working like 7 days a week, you're eating room service all the time. And
And so
you're eating the $40 burgers. Like, you're showing up jet lagged. You've got an event the next day. You've got to like write an article that night, and you're like, fuck it, I'm going to order the $40 burger. And, you're not sleeping well, you know. So it compounded a lot of the problems that were already there. And to your point about keeping the axe sharp, I think it really started to weigh down on my energy levels, my ability to focus, my ability to just do excellent work. And so it was, you know, I started to try to kind of address it even before I took the time off, but I lost a little bit of weight. But like once I knew I was going to take an extended period of time off, I was like, okay, let's hit the gym. Let's eat some salad. Let's do this shit.
Well, it's funny. Cause I've talked about this before. I think a lot of people think that like having a family or being like homebound or all these things that they hold you back. And in some respects, that's true. I think one of the things they hold you back from is kind of exactly what you went through, which was this sort of untethering or fundamental imbalance of having the ability to say yes to so many things. I mean, obviously, yeah. Look, there's plenty of people who have kids and houses and, you know, a lawn to mow and all these things, then they neglect all that because, you know, they're going on sales calls or, you know, they're building a company. But I think in a weird way, there's that Flaubert line about being sort of ordered in your life so you can be disordered in your work, you know, like you can be chaotic and experimental. I think it's hard when there's no good reason not to spend 5 months on the road, not spend 5 months on the road, right? Or you're like, the only thing holding me back from doing this is whether I say yes or no. It's hard to say no to the coolness of the thing, the financial remuneration of the thing, the guilt of not doing, et cetera. I think, like, to me, the only way to do a lot sustainably is to find a way that it slots in a somewhat balanced or ordered life, and you're doing it consistently day to day. You're acclimated at the altitude, as opposed to this more, which I think is more common, the sort of like binge and purge mentality that people get sucked into.
Yeah, I think it's you know, I forget if it's like Parkinson's law, but it's like the amount of time a task requires will shrink or expand the amount of time given to it. And I think a lot of the reason that is true is that the more commitments you have, the more you're forced to think about prioritization, organization, the more seriously you have to take, you know, your discipline. Like if you're at a event and people invite you out to the bar after, you know, afterwards, like you say no. You know, like you said, it's when you have kind of this blank slate to kind of run with everything. And that's something that I've struggled my entire life. Like I like a little bit of chaos. My personality is such that when I do something, I tend to overdo it. And I've always been that way. And I think I just did it with work and all these cool opportunities. And yeah, now it's like, it's time to like pull the reins in and sort my shit out.
Yeah. If you want to talk about catastrophic success, I read this thing about Lin-Manuel Miranda when Hamilton came out, you know, so the biggest play in the world, it blows up at this totally, you know, insane level, but he had, right as the play was starting, his first kid was born. So, you know, backstage after every night, people would be like, we're going here, this celebrity's coming. And he was like, I have to get home to the baby. Because the baby's going to wake up in the middle of the night. And if I don't get X hours of sleep, I won't. And, you know, assuming that I'm going to be involved in that, I'm not going to be able to perform the way that I need to perform the show. And his point was actually that, you know, having kids, instead of destroying his artistic life, it actually saved his artistic life in that unusual circumstance, because it forced him to be normal. And I think that's something that people who haven't had extreme success don't quite understand, how inherently destabilizing and unnerving and, you know, tempting it is. And that whatever you have to pull you back down to earth, whether it's, you know, hey, I'm training for a marathon, or I just had kids, or X, Y, or Z, is really, really, really important.
Yeah. And I think what you also don't realize, and I know I had to learn this the hard way, is that you kind of convince yourself, you're like, oh my God, an after party and this celebrity is going to be there. And you kind of,
it's work. I should do it. It's work.
Yeah. Like you convince yourself, you're like, oh, meeting this person is actually a really great networking opportunity. And it's going to be great to know this person, and who knows what sort of people they can introduce me to. And after a certain number of years, you just start to realize that it's 99% of it is completely pointless and just like ego gratification.
Yeah, that's actually a tricky thing. We should talk about that, because I'm of two minds of it. So one, COVID happens and that goes away for like a year, right? There's mm-hmm. no impromptu coffee meetings or big dinner parties or events or whatever. And I don't know about you, but my career didn't suffer for that, right? No. Like, and my personal happiness went up, my professional, you know, productivity went up. So it's like, it's a lie you're telling yourself that you should do this for work, that you need to do it. It's just not true.
Yeah. Yeah. I think you and I are in the same boat in this regard. Like you always talk about how books punch above their weight in terms of networking and the rooms that you get invited into. And as I think as young authors experiencing a lot of success for the first time, like that is very exciting and a little bit intoxicating at first. You're like, oh my God, like this so-and-so wants me to like come to his house or like have dinner or whatever. And you're just like, oh, this is crazy. Like, I can't believe this is happening. And then nothing comes of it. Like it's, you meet them, they're normal people. They like ask you the same questions 100 people email you and ask you every day. And it's like, you just have dinner and life goes on. And the funny thing is, the only actual kind of famous person that the famous person I did end up working with and doing a big project with and making a bunch of money with was Will Smith. And he just did it the old fashioned way. His team reached out to my agent and said, hey, is Mark available for a meeting? You know, there are no dinner parties. There are no after parties. There was like no like schmoozing at the, you know, the cocktail lounge or whatever. Like it was just classic being professional.
Well, the other part that's tricky for me though, is I go, okay, like what were some pivot points in my life? They came through relationships that I have. Someone I met who opened up this door. So it's like, it's this sort of contradictory thing, which is most of the stuff is totally extraneous, not important. That's why you should have a no new friends policy, you know, just stick to your stuff, say no to all this stuff. And yet if I had actually kept that rule my whole life, I probably wouldn't be here. And so that's the trickiness and the insidiousness of it, where you're like, but I should do this because you never know what it could lead to.
But I think I think there's a difference there, because when you said yes to those opportunities, you weren't Ryan Holiday, the successful and famous author. You were Ryan Holiday, like the college dropout trying to get your foot in the door, you know? Whereas I think, you know, for me, it was like the success from the books was opening these doors. And then I got excited and ran in, and then I was like, oh wait, why am I here? I'd rather be at home watching Netflix with my wife. Like
totally. For me, it's like, you know, I speak at events, which is a part of the way I make my living. And then I'll get invited to, well, this one doesn't pay, but it's the coolest event you've ever heard of in your life, you know? And the following people will be there. And I go, you know, like I feel like a dick saying, like, I only go to the ones that I'm working at. At the same time, I find that rules, really bright and clear rules, are super important as far as discipline is concerned, because it eliminates the gray area, the exceptions that you'll make, that, you know, inevitably when I do agree to one of those events, I'm like, oh yeah, this is why I have that rule.
Yeah. No, I'm with you on that.
So you talked about Parkinson's Law earlier. I'm curious about this movie that you did about The Subtle Art, because if there's any part of the American economy that embodies Parkinson's Law, it has been, in my experience, the Hollywood production process, which is like Conspiracy got optioned in the summer of 2017, and it still hasn't gone into production, but it almost always looks like it's about to. And I'm like, I've written 5 books since you guys have been working on this. How does this work? You know, was the process maddening for you, or was it exciting, or how did you take it?
So I went, when the book first got optioned, one of the first things my agent told me was, she said, these things pretty much never get made, so don't get your hopes up. And I was like, cool, noted. And I kind of did, you know, I had zero expectations going into it. It did end up getting financed. It did end up getting made. I mean, it took 2 to 3 years longer than I think everybody said it was going to take, but it did end up happening. And I really just kind of kept those same low expectations the entire time. You know, it was like, I knew the production company had optioned it. They've got a history of doing documentaries. They've turned a lot of books into documentaries. They do a good job. So I was like, okay, you know, it'll be fine. As long as it's not embarrassing, and as long as it's not like, as long as it's not like agonizing and waste a bunch of my time, then cool. And so the shooting process was a ton of fun. The creative process was fun. It was all fine. But yeah, it's that industry. One thing I've learned from that industry, not, you know, this project a little bit, but, you know, dealing with some other options of optioning of my IP, Hollywood seems to, it's like the more they tell you they love something and they can't wait to do it, the less likely it is to happen. It's this bizarre world where like everybody constantly has to kiss each other's ass and like inflate each other's egos. And I can't really, I think like part of it, the cynical explanation for that would just be like, it's a bunch of narcissists who are running around with cameras. But I also kind of understand that the reality of that industry requires a little bit of that, because it is such a small inbred industry, and you never know if, you know, this producer or this cinematographer that, you know, you had lunch with or whatever ends up being the person who brings you into the next film or introduces you to your next director, or you know, can make the connection to finance your next project. And so everybody has to be like completely inauthentically nice and excited to each other all the fucking time. And as a person who very much prides myself on being blunt and a little bit curmudgeonly, I just feel so out of place in these meetings. Like, I've never felt more out of place than on like conference calls with Hollywood studios, because everybody just tells everybody else how amazing they are and how great everything is going to be. And I'm the asshole in the corner who's like, okay, so have we done anything yet? Is there any deliverable yet?
What's know, that, like, a conflict between the sort of maker-manager distinction, and almost 99.9% of the people in that sphere are not makers, they're managers or paper pushers or, you know, agents of some kind. And so there is this, if you're a person who exists in a world where you sit down and make stuff, and then that stuff goes out into the world because you do a podcast or you make videos that you post on the internet, to then go, it's like you entered a world without gravity suddenly. You know what I mean? It's just, you're like, what? Nothing, none of the things I'm so used to taking for granted work here. And it's maddening.
It's a bizarre world where I think it's even more, you know, books, you know, coming from a background of blogging, books still make sense because, you know, just the process of consuming a book, you know, there's a lot more depth to it. It takes a lot more investment. there's a heritage behind books, there's a prestige behind books. And I do think film still has a lot of that prestige. Like there's something very notable and kind of gets everybody's ears to perk up when you say that you made a movie. Yes. But it's funny because I've been on, you know, now we're doing all the marketing and promotion cycle. And I've been on some of these calls with them and I can tell they're trying to get me hyped up. And at one point they told me, they're like, Mark, you realize like tens of thousands of people are going to see this movie. And I'm like,
tens of thousands.
It's killing me because I'm like, okay, you realize like if you just take my YouTube channel, which is like a very small thing of everything that I do, this movie, it's paying me less money. It's going to be seen by fewer people. I have less creative control. I have no control over the monetization or the promotion of it. You know, like how is this a good deal in any way, shape or form for me? You know, it's ultimately, I think they're a little bit stuck in the past. Very much in the same way the publishing industry often is of kind of like, you know, we're Hollywood. You should be so thankful to be here. You're so, you know, you should feel lucky. And not really, you know, considering that the reality of my career or a career like yours is just completely different. Like they can't even account for it in their usual calculations. So
there's a lot of things we know would be good for us. Problem is we don't have time. It's just tougher. I think therapy is like that. We all know that sitting down, talking to someone, really working on our issues will make a difference. So the problem is finding a therapist, driving across town, all of that, right? And that's where Talkspace comes in, today's sponsor. Because by doing everything online, Talkspace has made getting the help you want easier, more accessible, and more affordable. With Talkspace, you can sign up online and get a personalized match with a provider that's right for you, typically within 48 hours. You can have virtual sessions with your licensed therapist from the comfort of your home. And Talkspace is secure and private, using the latest end-to-end grade encryption to store client information and complying with the latest HIPAA regulations. As a listener of this podcast, you'll get $80 off your first month with Talkspace when you go to Talkspace.com/stoic and enter code SPACE80. To match with a licensed therapist today, go to Talkspace.com/stoic and enter promo code SPACE80, that's 80, to get $80 off your first month and show your support for the show. That's Talkspace.com/stoic, promo code SPACE80. Hims is changing men's healthcare by providing access to affordable sexual health treatments from the comfort of your couch. It's always sensitive talking about these things, but Hims is changing men's healthcare by providing access to doctor-trusted ED treatments such as chewable hard mints, brand name treatments like Viagra, or generic alternatives for up to 95% cheaper. The process is simple and 100% online. No uncomfortable doctor's visits. If prescribed, your medication ships to you for free. No insurance needed. Start your free online visit today at hims.com/TDS. That's hims.com/TDS for your personalized ED treatment options. Hard mints are a chewable compounded products which are not approved by or verified for safety or effectiveness by the FDA. Prescriptions require an online consultation with your healthcare provider who will determine if appropriate. Restrictions apply. See website for details and important safety information. Subscription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan.
Yeah, it's also interesting because obviously when you wrote The Subtle Art, it's sort of a screed against self-help, where it's a different kind of self-help. And the movie sort of is a continuation of that. And yet also, like, it is more self-helpy in the sense that it's like, oh, you can't read a book? Here, watch the movie. You know what I mean?
Yeah, you can't be bothered to read. Yeah, it's, you know, and this is the funny thing about it too, is I really like how the film turned out. Like, the creative process was really enjoyable from beginning to end. And filmmaking is so different from anything I do. And the process and it's so collaborative and involves so many moving pieces. And there's like dozens of people and they all know a little bit of what it's going to look like, but nobody seems to know completely what it's going to look like. And it was a very fascinating and interesting experience to go through it. And I do think that the movie turned out great. You know, one of our goals going into it, when I had early conversations with them, is I said, like, you know, I think one of the reasons Subtle Art worked was it was very disruptive to the self-help genre. It kind of like threw a curveball at a lot of people in situations that they weren't used to like seeing a curveball in a book. And I said, I'd love to do that with the movie. Like, it kind of take a documentary about a self-help documentary and just flip it on its head and then like do a bunch of wacky shit that kind of surprises people. And we did that. And it's the creative part of it, I love, and it was fun. And in a vacuum, I would gladly shoot another one and make another one. But it is that the industry is so anachronistic and just alien to me. I told my agent, I'm like, I am a tourist in this industry. Like, I feel like I'm in China or something and I don't speak the same language.
what do you feel like you have been trying to disrupt in self-help? Like, it is weird. Like, you write a book and then it gets sort of branded as that, but that's not, I think there's a very specific type of person who sits down and is trying to write a self-help book. And I don't think either of us is that person. But I certainly have no problem with people who like self-help books liking my stuff. And I certainly have no problem with the concept of people helping themselves. But it does seem like there's something you're striking against that you feel like is false or untrue or misleading in self-help. What is that to you?
To me, I feel like a lot of the traditional self-help industry is optimized for making people feel like they're changing and not actually changing.
Sure.
And I think especially when you get a lot of high-priced products and seminars and stuff involved in manipulative marketing tactics, and the fact that most consumers of self-help are vulnerable people in emotionally difficult spots in their lives. Like, I think there's a real ethical issue in the industry that I've always had a chip on my shoulder about. And, you know, I think a lot of it too is just offering more practical and better advice. You know, I look at like you, me, and James Clear, I feel like we're all kind of not hammering on the exact same thing, but we're kind of in the same territory in that, you know, it's the classic narrative in this industry was always like, these three tips will change your life this weekend. You know, give me $5,000 and come to this seminar and by Monday morning, you'll be a completely new person. And it's like, you know, I think you and I have been kind of hammering on the, you know, life is actually very difficult and struggles persist for a long time and there's no escaping it. And I think James has been kind of hammering on the change is actually extremely gradual and it happens, it's almost imperceptible over a long period of time. But I think out of the three of us, my writing style is just the most like layman. And if a random person who never reads a book is going to pick like read one of our books, it'll probably be mine. I think I get lumped into that category a lot more than you guys do.
Interesting.
Even though we're kind of like banging on the same drum.
Well, there's kind of this, there's like a conflict of interest in self-help, which is that there's clearly a lot of people who need help, right? And, and therefore delivering that help is potentially lucrative. But the most lucrative thing you could do would be to give them what feels like help, but it's not actually help, right? So like what you're just saying, it's like telling most of the time what people need to hear is not the same as what they want to hear. And so if you're a self-help artist, is probably what you should call it because it's similar to a con artist, I feel like. If you tell people what they want to hear, there's a much larger audience for you than if you tell people what they need to hear, or stepping even back further, if you simply say what is true, right? And yeah. So I think that is probably what I think both of us are reacting against. Like The Secret is the ultimate self-help book in that yes. it managed to reduce down to its essence exactly what people wish was true, but is fundamentally not true. And therefore sold probably the most copies of any self-help book ever written.
Yep. Yeah. And it's in, and not only that, but I think the saying what is true is actually far more difficult because it's, you have to wrap the uncomfortable truth in something that is shiny and sexy and a lot more palatable. You know, almost have to like give them sugar to make the medicine go down.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's a mission or a cause that I've had for pretty much since the beginning of my career. And I don't see any reason to stop anytime soon. I don't know. It keeps me fired up. It keeps me pissed off when I see a lot of this stuff out there. And I just feel like I need to like be the wet blanket. I was going to say something. I remember now, you know, relating to your point of like telling people what feels good. I think there's kind of an inherent, not bias, but like, Our mind plays a trick on us. Like when we have an experience that's extremely emotional, a side effect of that is that we tend to assume that it must be very meaningful. Mm. And so I think what a lot of self-help content does is it's very good at triggering an emotional response and then telling the person like, look how emotional you are. You just had this life-changing moment. But people don't realize that it's, you know, emotions and identity and behavior change are actually two completely different things. So yeah, I just feel like it's a magic trick that has just been used over and over and over again.
Yeah. It's also like, so I've noticed that my books have gotten longer the more, I think I've talked about this before, but my books have gotten longer as I've gone. And I'm trying to be aware and on guard that I'm not getting more self-indulgent as I go on. And in mm-hmm. fact, it's because as I experience more and know more, I come to realize what you said, which is that the truth is a hard thing to say. It's a hard thing to wrap your head around. It's a complicated thing. And so in a way, the more kind of like delusional you are, egotistical you are, self-absorbed you are, it actually makes being successful as a self-help author easier because you dispense with nuance very easily and you just sort of self-assuredly reduce some super complicated thing down to nothing. Like, I'll give you an example. I wrote this article when I was like 22 years old about dropping out of college, which I had just recently done, right? And so I was, you know, somewhat biased towards it being a good idea. I was rationalizing it. I still think it's a relatively good idea. But as I've gotten older, when people ask me about dropping out of college, my answer is no longer like, yes, of course you should do it. Because yeah. I don't want the weight of that on me. And I have a much more nuanced, complicated take on it. And so I think like, if you're a simple-minded person, you could write The Secret or whatever. If you see reality as complicated and complex and people as complicated and complex, it becomes harder and harder to give advice generally because you no longer even accept such a thing as possible.
See, Ryan, your problem is you have a conscience. If you yes. didn't have a conscience, you could just
so
write this. You'd sell so many more books. Like,
well, I actually do. People will go like, it's weird. You can't get credit for the bad you don't do. But sometimes people will say things like, oh, you're just doing this to make money. And you're like, if that's what I cared about, let me tell you how yeah, like, easy that would be. Yeah. And how many more books like,
do you think I'd be studying Seneca for 10 years if I just wanted to make money?
yeah. Or, you know, you look at these like you look at the Tai Lopez's or the Andrew Tates of the world, these people that sort of blow up in this huge way online and make lots and lots and lots of money. It's a combination of probably both ignorance and sociopathy at the same time that that allows them to act and be that way. And then, you know, people who are not in a good place fall victim to that.
Yeah, it's really sad because the nature of most people who come to self-help, the reason they have problems in their lives is because they are chronically unable to take responsibility for themselves and their own choices. And so what do? They find somebody, you know, like a Tai Lopez or an Andrew Tate, who is willing to give them all the answers and relinquish them of the responsibility for making choices in their own lives. And it's like this kind of gross codependent relationship that happens at scale and then is monetized. And I do think it's getting better. I actually, like, not to pat us on the back, but like, I think you, me and James have like really, and I'd add Tim Ferriss in there and a few other people. Like I really
Cal
think
Newport does a great job. Yeah. There's a bunch of people.
Yeah. I think it's the trend is moving in the right direction. And I think the material, what is kind of mainstream self-help material is on average, becoming higher quality and becoming more helpful. But yeah, there's still a lot of nonsense out there.
Yeah, I think it's good to see proof or to prove to the market that you can write thoughtful, nuanced, you know, also entertaining, accessible stuff that makes a real difference for people that doesn't involve, you know, complete and total nonsense. And that deciding to go that way, let's say up market, isn't somehow like career suicide. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's interesting. I think the video is good too, because like or the movie is great in this sense too, is like your point that like people read your books who maybe don't read a lot. I think that's great. I have also come further along in my sort of worldview, which is like, I am a person who reads and learns via books. Mm-hmm. And that's simply how it panned out for me, but that's not necessarily superior or better than someone who learns from podcasts or someone who likes TikTok. Like I've come more around to the idea of like, what matters is the idea and the truth you're delivering. You should go in whatever medium you're best in, but then also once something has worked, again, we're going back to this idea of obligation, but I think there's almost an obligation to try to translate it in as many mediums as possible to reach people who would not have accessed it through a book or whatever that other art form that you're in is.
100%. And I mean, you and I, the vast, almost everything we write, these are not new ideas. I mean, you are very explicit in that these are not new. These are thousands of years old, but you know, even a criticism I often get from people is they say like, well, you didn't come up with this. Like this came from Nietzsche or whatever. Yeah. And I'm like, well, no shit. But like, are you going to go read Nietzsche? Like I very much see my job as doing what you just said, which is kind of taking timeless, very important ideas and translating them in such a way that they're accessible to the person who is never going to go to the philosophy section of a bookstore. But
or
still
not
help
right
them
now, like right
or
now,
maybe not now.
Not
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I just wrote like, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, but it just helped, you know, they can still get the benefit from the idea if it's delivered in a different package.
I just wrote a Daily Stoic email about this. It hasn't gone out, but I was saying, you know, people who are like, they'll go like, why would I need a coin to remind me that I'm going to die someday? Or like, why would I need to read one page of the Stoics every day? And my response is sort of like, maybe you don't. You know what I mean? Like, maybe you don't. But there is this narcissism in assuming that everything that is made must first and foremost be for you, right?
For like, me, yes.
Yeah, like maybe you are further along than a high school dropout who just, you know, went through a soul-crushing divorce and is trying to rebuild their life and doesn't know where to start, or somebody who just, you know, had a major health scare and they want this. Not everything is for you. People are in very different places than you. I came to the Stoics through the actual Stoics, but I also did that in a college apartment in America that my parents were paying for, right? I had time and space and privileges and advantages and an education that not everyone does. And that's not to say that the people who read my stuff are stupid. It's, in fact, many of them are very, very, very smart. They've already read the originals and they are looking for a reminder of what's in the original. So the point is, there is this kind of elitism and narcissism of going like, well, that's simple. I don't need that. And it's like, maybe you're right, but you are not everyone.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's, you know, not even where people are in their lives, but also just fundamental personalities. Like some people need reminders often. Some people don't. Some people have great memories. Some people don't. You know, it takes all kinds in the world. And the thing too about these concepts, you know, both the Stoic concepts and these other philosophical kind of self-help concepts, is you're never done with them. Like you never stop. You're like, oh, okay, I got the gratitude thing figured out. Like, don't have to worry about that. It is a daily practice. Like you have to do it repeatedly. And like a muscle, you will lose it if you don't keep it up.
Yeah. And weirdly, I think even bouncing between the mediums is really helpful. So your reader watched the documentary, you're a podcast person, actually try reading the book. I think you get different flavors and angles on the stuff by being sort of multidisciplinary in how you learn about stuff, and not just being an elite snob. It doesn't serve you or anyone, and it's super obnoxious.
Yeah. All right. So don't be a snob. That's what we've learned today. That's today's lesson. Don't be a snob. Yes.
Well, it's like to go to your one thing not to give a fuck about is how other people consume their information or food or lifestyle. I think we have a huge problem caring too much about what other people do in their private fucking lives.
Yes, I run into that all the time. Like I'll do a reading recommendation list and people will email me and they're like, well, I tried to read the first two books and I didn't enjoy them. Like, what should I do? And I'm like, then don't read them. It's fine. there's no wrong answer here.
Yeah, there's a Thomas Jefferson line he was saying about something. He's like, it neither breaks my leg or picks my pocket, right? That was his sort of standard for what should be allowed or not. And I think that's a good way of thinking about it. Like, what do you care? I saw a TikTok about this. Someone was just saying like, when someone tells you they like something, you don't need to tell them your opinion on that thing. You can just let them like that thing. And I was like, that's so great. And it's such a better way to live too. Like, why is it important to me to let this person who likes something know that I think what they like sucks?
Yeah, it doesn't help anything.
Well, I think your stuff is great and I'm pumped about the movie and it's always fun to talk, man.
Yeah, absolutely, dude. Good to catch up.
Hey, it's Ryan. Thank you for listening to the Daily Stoic podcast. I just wanted to say we so appreciate it. We love serving you. It's amazing to us that over 30 million people have downloaded these episodes in the couple years we've been doing it. It's an honor. Please spread the word, tell people about it. And this isn't to sell anything. I just wanted to say thank you. Hey,
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to The Daily Stoic early and ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen early and ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Guy Raz's How I Built This is a podcast where each week he talks to the founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn the real stories of how they built them. In each episode, you hear these entrepreneurs really go into their story. And Guy is an incredible interviewer. He doesn't just dance around the surface. He has real questions because he himself is an entrepreneur. He's built this huge show and this huge company. In a recent episode, they talked to the founder of Liquid Death, that crazy water company that's become this billion-dollar brand. Follow the show on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to How I Built This early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. And for a deep dive in daily business content, listen to Wondery V. Destination for Business podcasts with shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Wondery means business.